Today, we have two presenters on Japan and East Asia. The question is still a special path. Is the East Asian model still holding? Has it been transformed? If so, to what extent and where? We are very lucky to have the two people who are here, both of whom have worked very intensively on this question. Meredith Jung-un Wu is our first presenter. She is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And she is, as I said, one of the leading analysts of East Asian development, the East Asian model, and its state. I think probably people got to know her first with her book called The Race to the Swift, State and Finance in Korean Industrialization, really a very major contribution to a field in which there's really, I think, for the last 15, 20 years or so, has had a very high level of scholarship. Meredith is one of the leaders. Other works since that, Capital Ungoverned, Liberalizing Finance in Interventionist States, The Developmental State, 1999, so you can see the kind of work that she's done very much on the issues of this colloquium today. And After the Miracle, Neoliberalism and Institutional Reform in East Asia, is coming out in 2007 from the UN Research Institute for Social Development. Finally, I just should mention, she's currently finishing two manuscripts in this area. One is entitled Three Worlds of East Asian Capitalism, about the historical evolution of capitalism in Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, and China. Those are the three worlds of East Asian capitalism. The other is entitled The Ruins of Modernity, about the economic disaster in North Korea. Thank you very much for visiting us, Meredith.
Thank you. So, Chad? Good afternoon, and I'd like to thank Bob Brenner and Tom Mertes and Center for Social Theory and Comparative History for inviting me today. Does this microphone work?
Yes.
Okay.
Just
a little.
Yes.
All right.
It's just going the other way, so we can
hear it. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the Asian financial crisis, so this has been a good year for the crisis buffs, as there are conferences taking place all over the place in Washington, Tokyo, Seoul, all the way down to Jakarta. And all of this, of course, depends, this celebration of the Asian crisis, on how you date this crisis. I tend to date it to July 1997, when Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir, declared the attack on the Thai baht and the Malay ringgit as the worldwide Jewish conspiracy against Asian economies, and of course led by George Soros, the head of Quantum Funds. And this Asian crisis it didn't really last very long, and one could argue that it was, the recovery was V-shaped. And by some reckoning, this crisis lasted barely 13 months, and by the last quarter of 1998, the crisis, one could argue, was over, all the way from Korea down to Indonesia. And today, you have, in these countries, there are central banks' coffers overflowing with plenty of reserve over the reserve requirement, and they of course go a very long way to finance our war in Iraq, to the tune of something like $500 billion being pumped in. Now, lest you think that this crisis has been too brief, to the relief of many crisis buffs, the crisis, one could argue, is a longer one, depending on once again how you date it. So if you add countries like Brazil and Russia that went through the financial crisis in 1998, not to mention Argentina that went through the crisis from 1999 to maybe 2003, one could say that, let's say my colleagues in Argentina can look forward to six more years of crisis celebration unless, of course, there is another Argentine crisis meanwhile, which is highly likely. In fact, I think something is quite wrong that for the last 4 years it's been really quiet in Argentina. This Asian crisis, as you recall, was a classic liquidity crisis with the usual dramatis persona present. You had institutional fund managers that pumped huge amount of money into the region and pumped it out even faster out of the region. And I don't know who it was that said that there's nothing more sordid than panicky capitalists, but what we saw in 1997-8 was something that proved that description apt. And then you also had Treasury officials doing their finger pointing in line with the newest Washington consensus, namely that the economic crisis wasn't really macroeconomic or microeconomic, but it was the problem that was caused by institutional problems. So suddenly, Washington, people began talking about crony capitalists and all kinds of non-performing loan problems caused by these crony capitalists in East Asian countries. And then you also had the same cast of characters as you see in many other financial crises, namely IMF officials doing their bidding, coming into these countries with their high interest rate policies, doing what one might call a demolition derby on small businesses that were already under massive stress. Although I have to say in defense of the IMF that their policy sort of became more sophisticated and more flexible as time went on. And then in addition to all this, you had real human tragedy that unfolded as bankruptcies occurred among big and small businesses alike. There were massive layoffs, there were riots, and perhaps you might remember 10 years ago or 9 years ago, there were pogroms all over Indonesia against ethnic Chinese. Now, what did all of this mean? Was there any kind of larger meaning to this crisis than the run-of-the-mill happenstance captured by Kindleberger's descriptive title, Mania, Panic, and Crash? Today, I want to suggest the following idea as a way to try to situate the Asian crisis that occurred and to think through some of the implications of this crisis. What I'd like to suggest today is that this crisis was a historical marker, and that with this crisis, an epoch ended, or I might say an epoch went up in flame, and this flame metaphor is something I'm going to stick to. So I'll say that an epoch went up in flame, and that this period marked an opening of a new era, which was actually really an old era, that is the Sinocentric regional world. Or world order. And symbolically, one could argue that it was actually when the Chinese dropped the official exchange rate of renminbi in 1994, when artificially Chinese yuan was linked to a dollar at 5.8 yuan, and then dropped it to market rate of 8.7 yuan to a dollar, that it triggered a real crisis and destroyed a Thai ability to export and service their debt. So one could say in that regard that Asian crisis occurred earlier. As you might remember, and as you can imagine, when something like that happens, that puts tremendous pressure on the Thai baht, on any currency in a place near China. But the problem was the Thai baht was fixed and had to be defended. And this was a real double whammy, and actually it turns out that George Soros' Quantum Fund recognized this as being untenable and began selling the Thai baht short, and the rest, of course, is history. So looked at this way, perhaps one should have celebrated the Asian crisis 3 years ago. Now, I said that this period was a historical marker, and what I mean by that is that people will remember, I think, many, many decades later, that this period marked a reorientation of East Asia back into the Chinese fold. And what I want to talk about today is how, in this post-crisis period, different countries try to accommodate their economies in this Sino-centric world order or regional order as best they can. It's a real scramble. And how they're accommodating to this new regional order, as I said, is something that I want to touch on, but probably not very profoundly. This is something I'm beginning to think more systematically in recent days. But let's pause at this notion, Chinese regional order. What might you look like in the 21st century? It so happens that somebody else pondered this question in precisely the same way, exactly 100 years ago, and that is in 1907, and that person is Jack London of the Call of the Wild fame. In 1907, Jack London happened to write a science fiction story about the how world would accommodate ascendant China. This science fiction story that he wrote in 1907 takes place about a century later, which is to say now. Right? And this story is called The Unparalleled Invasion, and the story goes something like this. As Jack London sees it, in the first half of the 20th century, China learns the rope of industrialization from Japan and learns the art of manufacturing at the feet of the master. And the master, Japan, meanwhile, develops into a niche economy. Does some manufacturing here and there, but by and large, Japan specializes in aesthetics. So Japan excels in art, and in design, in bonsai trees, in tea ceremony, and seemed entirely content on being this niche economy. Meanwhile, China develops into an industrial powerhouse and becomes the manufacturer for the world. And the world watches this greatest industrial explosion in China with great weariness and bemusement. And bemusement because the Chinese didn't seem at all interested in building a big standing army or in building a sizable blue water navy. And meanwhile, you see large segments of Chinese population spilling out of the borders and going to different countries. And the world is worried. The next thing you know, there is a chemistry professor who is seen traveling the Bosch corridor down to White House, and then soon after that, you see some airplanes departing American air bases, and they dump turkey feathers all over China. And in 2 weeks, China is completely emptied of the Chinese. And so after that, all the civilized nations of the West gather in Versailles and declare never again, and they declare also a ban on genocide. So that's how the story ends. And the people of Europe and Western world goes in to China and repopulates China. Now, this is a very embarrassing story for the Jack London buffs. And I noticed that in the unabridged collected works of Jack London, the story is not included. I actually haven't been able to find, except in this one source that I found and from which I read this story. It's just the story is universally dropped. Well, yes, but it's a matter of degrees, and one could argue that this was really quite an embarrassing story for the Jack London fans. Now, I found the story very interesting for a number of reasons, but let me just flag your attention to two aspects of this story. One, I found it interesting because what it shows is the essential bafflement of the world at China, especially with regards to the problem of accommodating their great commercial genius and energy. Genius and energy of people who account for one out of every six members of humanity. This is as baffling at the time of Jack London as it is today, or one might say as baffling at the time of Max Weber, who therefore wrote a book called wrote accounts of China and rise of capitalism as it is today. The second thing I found interesting about this story is that Jack London pointed to the essential and relatively peaceful nature of the resurgent China, which has been recognized as true for those having to live on the fringes of the Middle Kingdom. Now, the Vietnamese might disagree, but this is not a debate we want to get into. You know, Jack London might have been very unkind to the Chinese in China, but nonetheless, he did report from the Far East during the Russo-Japanese War, and he did put his finger on the essential nature of this empire, the Chinese Empire. And he did put his finger on the fact that the Chinese seemed to have singular interest in commerce rather than war. And one might also say that this was true of the early 15th century when Admiral Zheng He, a eunuch from Ming China whose fleet girdled the globe, including finally East Africa, with merely a thought about military conquest. And this too is true today. This regional order today is more interested in money-making than in military expansionism. Now, let's come back from Jack London's reverie to our current reverie, namely about what kind of historical marker 1997 and 1998 might have proved. Let me suggest that the old order that this Asian financial crisis put an end to was what one might call a post-World War II order. And I might say that this post-World War II order was characterized by four pillars or characteristics. This was an argument that Ben Anderson has advanced, but let me elaborate on this. What he said was that this order was based on, he described it as a Cold War order, and the way it seems is that I would politically describe it as an order where you had continuous U.S. support for political stability all throughout East Asia. That meant that in South Korea, four-decade-long support for tough-as-nails anti-communists in power regardless of their disastrous politics. In Indonesia, this meant support for three decades of Suharto's new order, otherwise known as capitalism in one family. That's one pillar. The second pillar, one might argue, was Japanese economic dominance, or let me say increasing Japanese investment in Southeast Asia, culminating sometime in the 1980s. Now, Japan went into Southeast Asia and began repairing relationships with the countries it formerly occupied, starting with, in the late 1950s, reparations all throughout Southeast Asia, and by 1965, Japan concludes reparations with South Korea. And to South Korea, it supplies aid, provides exports, and provides technology transfer. To Southeast Asia, Japan begins to invest in natural resources and helps start of manufacturing, which all got buffeted by the rising yen, which reaches the peak with the Plaza Accord when the United States stiff-armed the Japanese into reflating their currency, which of course opened the floodgate of investment into Southeast Asia. And one might argue that all of this kind of reached a real crescendo by the mid-1990s when Vice Minister for International Finance, Mr. Sakakibara, willy-nilly told the world about the idea for the Asian Monetary Fund until finally the U.S. Treasury slapped his wrist and told him to shut up, whereupon he did. The third pillar of the Southeast Asian industrialization that characterized the old order was the presence of ethnic Chinese entrepreneurs all over Southeast Asia. They were the true locomotive of Southeast Asian industrialization. The presence of ethnic Chinese entrepreneurs in Thailand, in Philippines, in Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia. And for our purpose, let us note that up to the time of the financial crisis, this diaspora might have been linked with each other, but this was not linked to mainland China. After the crisis, this situation would radically change. Now, the fourth aspect of the old order was that industrialization in East Asia occurred in a highly artificial setting, an artificial and controlled setting which is based on the four-decade-long sequestration of China. With China cordoned off, Southeast Asia had embarked on what we came to call a miracle. But this miracle was short-lived because this miracle unfortunately started only in the 80s. And in that short miracle, what you saw was something like in the land of the blind, one-eyed man was king, that Southeast Asia developed, had a so-called miracle, but you know this wasn't real. So like I said, this old order was finished by 1997. And let me get back to my metaphor. I said that it went up in flame. And by this, I mean this both metaphorically and literally. To any serious catastrophe buffs or crisis buffs, the real crisis of 1997 and 1998 wasn't even financial. The real crisis was ecological, and it was a catastrophe. 1997-98 was the year of El Niño Southern Oscillation, otherwise called ENSO, and it turns out it was the worst ever in history, in the 300 years recorded history of El Niño Southern Oscillation. And this year, 1997-98, that El Niño had a very long reach, stretching from Syria to Mongolia to People's Republic of China, to North Korea, to Southeast Asia, devastating at its wake several developing countries that were hapless before climatic aberrations. Severe winter in Tibet wiped out 20% of all livestock. In Mongolia, 3 million livestock got wiped out. There was a threat of massive starvation in Tajikistan, which was barely averted. And of course, the full fury of this ecological disaster was felt in North Korea, which was in the eye of the Holocaust, and through the famine caused or accelerated in part by this, North Korea lost upwards of 1 million lives. In Indonesia, this El Niño-related drought caused devastating fire, which ripped right through its tinder-dry forest, causing forest damage of 18,000 square miles, and enveloped the entire Southeast Asia in smoke and haze. And when the smoke and haze cleared in 98, East Asia was another country. Manufacturing miracle in Southeast Asia was no more, and is never, ever going to be repeated. If in the period before the crisis, manufacturing miracle translated into 7 to 9% in annual growth of the economy, at best today, in the best of the times, you have 4 to 6% growth rate. It's not bad, but it's no miracle. So having said that, let me go back to the four pillars of the old order that I recited before, and let's see how this changed. Let's go back to the first order, that is the political order of the old order, the political support the United States provided during the Cold War. With the crisis, South Korea saw the inauguration for the first time of politicians from the opposition party, and people that came into power were people who cut their teeth throwing Molotov cocktail on the street, who were familiar with political protest. And one might say that eventually the same thing happened in Taiwan, to a lesser extent in Thailand. In Malaysia, we saw in 1997 and 8, Prime Minister Mahathir, who stood on his hind legs and eventually did the right thing by imposing capital control, but he committed a cardinal sin for a politician. He took on a guy bigger than himself, otherwise known as George Soros, in Mahathir's words, the leader of the Jewish conspiracy around the world, and by 1993, Mahathir was a goner. And in Indonesia, 30 years of brutal new order came to an end, to be replaced by a series of feckless so-called democratic leadership. So something fundamentally has changed after 97. What about the second pillar, the Japanese economic dominance? Well, as Japan itself went into doldrums, Japan's spillage into Southeast Asia also went into something of doldrums. And if in the past, let's say in the 80s and 90s, Japan strutted all over Southeast Asia for investment, doing investment in natural resources and manufacturing, today you see not only the Japanese, but more pronouncedly you see Koreans and the Chinese doing the same thing rather than the Japanese, and ditto with tourism. So you see the replacement of the Japanese for other East Asians, especially in the years to come, you will see the Chinese doing this. Third pillar we looked at was the Chinese diaspora, the true locomotive of the Southeast Asian miracle. After 1997, there occurred a relinking of this diaspora with the origination point of this diaspora, that is the People's Republic of China. To me, one illustration was this. In 1998, I was in China, I was in Chuanzhou, which is the origin point, actually, it turns out, where the same Admiral Zheng He led the commercial fleets in 1903 and 1904 around the world into Djibouti. And I happened to give a talk at a Chinese university called the Overseas Chinese University. And people were complaining mightily to me about how the dorms were overflowing and they couldn't accommodate people. And I said, why are your dorms overflowing? And they said, well, because in 1998, when there were pogroms all over in Indonesia, the Chinese government had to send ships to pick up 800 girls because there were rapes going on against the ethnic Chinese. So having rescued 800,000 young women, and they said two men, that the dorms were overflowing. But to me, that was very interesting. What it signaled to me, that it's the overseas Chinese who are the spider stitching East Asia together into a coherent regional order. They're not the only spiders creating this web into otherwise known as the regional Sinocentric order, but you know, this is happening, and I think this is also happening across the Pacific also in what we might call another unparalleled invasion, just as the title of Jack London's story. And finally, let's look at the fourth pillar, the sequestration of China. Well, that's over. China is out, the genie is out, and today what you see is that South Korea, for instance, is China's second largest export market after the U.S. and Japan. And South Korea, China is also second most important country for South Korea in terms of imports. For China, South Korea is its fourth largest export market, and it's the second largest country from which China imports. Now, that's quite surprising, but what's even more surprising is when you look at North Korea. After the conflagration, especially of ecological conflagration that I talked about, which exacerbated the North Korean famine, North Korea emerged out of this catastrophe in 1997-8 as a transition economy. But transiting to what? It transited, number one, into a market economy, an informal economy, but it also transited into a colony of China, an economy completely 100% reliant on China. You know, I walked into a couple markets in North Korea, one in Pyongyang and one in Najin, and I was appalled to find that there was not a thing produced in North Korea by the North Koreans themselves. Every drab Kim Il-sung uniform you find in Pyongyang was made in China, and every last red brick you find in Pyongyang that they use for construction was made in China as well. And Chinese relationship with ASEAN is getting very heavy, very thick, although not in the direction you might anticipate. Rather than Chinese investing a lot in ASEAN countries, you see ASEAN investing in China by tenfold. And what it also indicates is that you have the only people with a lot of money, which are the diasporic Chinese communities now investing in China, once again, as I mentioned, stitching the regional order together. So let me conclude by asking, well, how will the region accommodate China? How does East Asia accommodate China? And the responses range from most active ones on the part of the Koreans, North and South, to more passive ones as you go down south, southward to Southeast Asia. Now, Korea has long been a tributary state to China, culturally, philosophically, politically. They are much more at ease with China than almost any other tributary states. There are more Koreans today studying in China than almost any other people from any other place. Yet, the Koreans are profoundly worried by their own tendency of being drawn to China. So both North and South Korea are reaching out to the United States to balance their own worst tendencies in many ways and to balance the influence of the Chinese behemoth. For North Korea, that means that they want to change partners of their tried and true foreign policy. For the longest time, until the collapse of the Soviet Union, the North Korean foreign policy was always balancing the Soviets against the Chinese. These days, North Koreans want to introduce or get the U.S. implicated in North Korea so that they can balance the U.S. against the Chinese. With the South Koreans, they had 4 decades record in also something similar in playing with dual hegemonic power, namely the United States and Japan. And now South Koreans want to do something different, that is to balance power between the United States and China and then try to survive in the interstices of these two major influences. So in the most singular radical act, South Koreans did something unthinkable for a country that used to be the template for the developmental state. They abandoned industrial policy and went big time for free trade. They want to conclude free trade agreement with the United States, which will be decided in July as the Congress goes up and down on fast track on this agreement. In a very big historical gamble, what the South Koreans want to do, they feel they're ready to do this, is to marry their human capital, which they feel is competitive, with American science and technology and expertise in human services, so that they can survive, maybe go head-to-head with the Chinese, even if the conclusion of that would be to make South Korea into the 51st state of the United States, which they're happy to be. And if looking at UCLA campus, it looks like that already happened. South Korea is clearly...
Berkeley,
right. South Korea is a pilot project. If Washington approves this, going thumbs up in July, Tokyo, which is watching what's happening extremely closely, will be following not exactly in his footsteps, but will be trying to figure out how to deal not only with a resurgent China, but a Korea that in a radical way decided to gamble its economic fate on getting close with the United States. Now, in the 21st century, how does the U.S. deal with this challenge from China? Obviously, Turkey feather strategy, as Jack London described, is not an option. And what we see today are, I think, 2 very interesting initiatives. One is, within the region in Southeast Asia, you have perhaps regional initiatives characterized by Chiang Mai Initiative, which is based on self-help support mechanism, mostly by currency swap and other agreement, and this is likely to grow. But more importantly, I think that the American strategy is what we're seeing with South Korea, which is concluding bilateral treaties, commercial treaties with various partners. So even if you don't have regional free trade, by the time you conclude one bilateral, another bilateral, pretty much you create a huge web so that you end up with an open trade that crisscross the Pacific. And like I said, Korea is the opening salvo of this movement, and in some really important ways, I would posit that this is the latest American response to the unparalleled invasion, and whether this will work, only time will tell. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, our second presenter is Ron Bavakwa, who was here about 10 years ago. It was in the wake of, what year was it? It was in the wake of the Asian crisis. It must have been 1998-9, something like that. And in fact, I think was analyzing in the first moments the implications of the Asian crisis for the East Asian economy. Ron worked for 10 years as a macroeconomist for Merrill Lynch in Tokyo, 1993 to 2002. Today, he's contributing editor for the Economist Intelligence Unit, again working on macroeconomics based, as he is still, in Tokyo. His main work is as executive director of Planet Finance Japan, which is a global microfinancial NGO centered, interestingly enough, in Paris and headed up by Jacques Attali. People may remember him. I just mentioned, as I always often do vis-a-vis Ron and his work, I think one of the best, still one of the very best introductions to the East Asian crisis, and I think a terrific point of departure for understanding sort of the subsequent growth, subsequent evolution in East Asia, is his article on the East Asian crisis in the Review of International Political Economy, which came out, I believe, in 19. 19-